Smart litigators find winning arguments faster with Bloomberg Law. Our market-leading docket coverage has AI-driven search and analytics, customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And that's not all. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com for everything you need to win.
What happens when the person filing the lawsuit isn't the person funding the lawsuit? When that happens, you've got litigation finance, and on today's episode, we learn about this murky part of the legal world and hear about how litigation finance may have been used to try to evade international sanctions. Hello, you're listening to On the Merits, the news podcast from Bloomberg Law and Bloomberg Government. I'm your host, David Schultz. So I think the first time a lot of folks learned about the concept of litigation finance was back in 2016. That was when it was revealed that Peter Thiel was secretly bankrolling a defamation lawsuit from former wrestler Hulk Hogan against the online news site Gawker. Although, actually, this wasn't really an example of litigation finance, and we'll explain why in a bit.
According to you, that's right. Billionaire Peter Thiel, who made his fortune creating PayPal and is one of the very first investors in Facebook, is speaking out, sharing details about why he spent millions of dollars financing Hulk Hogan's winning case against Gawker Media.
Thiel backed this suit for personal reasons. He was upset with Gawker for what he saw as invasive coverage of himself and others. He told the New York Times he considered his financing of the lawsuit as, quote, one of the greater philanthropic things I've done, unquote. But Peter Thiel is definitely not the only person financing lawsuits, and almost none of those who do it are for philanthropic reasons. Bankrolling a suit with a big potential payout has become an increasingly common way for attorneys and investors to make money. But while most litigation financiers are just looking to make a buck, the murky rules about this practice make it hard to say just who is funding these lawsuits and why. For example, Bloomberg Law reporters John Holland and Emily R. Siegel recently learned about a Russian company with close ties to Vladimir Putin that financed the creditors in US and UK bankruptcy proceedings. And this was after several founders of the company, A1, were hit with international sanctions following the Russian invasion of Ukraine. John and Emily join us today to talk about why this was so problematic and why some attorneys say this was an attempt to use litigation finance to skirt these sanctions. But first, I asked Emily to explain to me what exactly litigation finance is.
Yeah, so litigation finance is when an entity finances or funds a case in exchange for a portion of the award if the case is successful. So the Gawker case is not really litigation finance because it's not financially motivated. It is kind of a sect of it, but most of this is just financial. So it's sort of these large companies or smaller companies that have a certain amount of capital. They put it towards cases that they view meritorious, and then they value them like an asset. So they can do that either with one case or a portfolio of cases, and there are a variety of different ways to do it. But it's all financially motivated.
And this is just, you know, for a case that an investor thinks is likely to succeed, they just look at it like an investment, like you'd be investing in a company that would rise in value.
Exactly. It's usually teams of financial people and lawyers. So it's sort of both types of backgrounds. And they look at these cases, they look at where they are in the, you know, in the process, what kind of dispositions they've had, what jurisdiction it is, and whether they think there will be a successful monetary outcome. And then they value it and decide how much to put into it.
Now, this is very controversial, and one of the main reasons is disclosure, because in some cases, the defendants in these lawsuits don't know that the litigation against them is being financed by someone else. What are the rules for disclosure when it comes to this kind of thing?
So the disclosures are kind of all over the map. There are some states that have them in their state courts, so that would mean that every party in a case would have to file a disclosure that says if they have third-party financing. It's typically the plaintiffs that do. There's some that have more detailed disclosures. They would require a contract. Some might even want the amounts, but it's not really universal yet. So a couple of states have passed bills. Some courts have. Federal District Court in New Jersey requires that you disclose if you have funding, and certain states have also done that, but it's not really everywhere yet. And then there's this bill in Congress that has not moved, but it is also requiring disclosure of if there are foreign investors involved in a case.
But it sounds like the takeaway is that there are still some places, maybe lots of places, where you can bankroll litigation in secret. You don't need to tell anyone that you're doing this or even tell the opposing party that you're doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. There are many places, the majority of places you don't have to disclose yet, and the majority of courts. So there are definitely plenty of places where there could be financing involved and nobody knows.
All right, John, let's move to you now and talk about this, bankruptcy suit that you guys got a bird's eye view into. It's pretty wild. It involves two Russian siblings who were accused of embezzling money in Russia, and a Russian financial regulator is trying to claw back some of that money. Why don't you take it from there? What led to that bankruptcy?
Russian courts had convicted a brother and sister of embezzling around $2 billion from one of the larger banks in Moscow. And that is not unusual in Russia. At that point, the central bank, their equivalent of like the FDIC, goes around the world trying to recover money. One of the stops was in New York. And it was a bankruptcy case. It was forced into bankruptcy. And there were as much as $20 million to recover through apartments and other property and bank accounts.
The Russian central bank turned to this company, A1. This is the center of your story here, as a way to help them get this money back. What is A1 and what were they doing?
It's not just an ordinary company. They are very powerful. It was founded by Mikhail Friedman, Peter Avon, and German Kahn. So they have strong ties financially and politically going back to Yeltsin.
And it sounds like, based on your reporting, they have strong ties to the current leader of Russia, Vladimir Putin.
Especially Peter Avon. According to the Mueller report, he met fairly regularly with Putin, as did other businessmen, and actually took marching orders from Putin to try to win influence in the U.S. political system to maybe help avoid sanctions if they ever did come their way.
But getting back to this case, so far we have the Russian central bank trying to get money from these overseas accounts. They turn to a private company to help them do that. So far, that sounds more or less above board. But we have the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Lots and lots of Russian businesses are sanctioned, including, it sounds like, A1.
No, actually, A1 wasn't sanctioned.
Oh.
There's where it gets a little tricky. The three founders were sanctioned, but the company itself wasn't. But it really wasn't material at this point. There was $6.1 million in an escrow account in the bankruptcy. As soon as the three founders were sanctioned in Moscow, the New York lawyers for A1 went into a frenzy.
Yeah.
They started filing and ordering the escrow agent to ship the money back.
And let's clarify why they were so worried, because when you're sanctioned, you can't do any business in the country that's sanctioning you. So the money that was in this escrow account that A1 was trying to get back, if they weren't able to get it back right away, it would essentially be frozen, right?
Exactly. So there really was no way to get the money back unless you beat the judge to it. And that's where there were a flurry of activity. The Russian foreign representative, essentially the bankruptcy trustee in Moscow, ordered the New York escrow agent to send the money back. A team of New York lawyers started putting together opinions telling this escrow agent, you can send the money back. He didn't believe it. He got nervous. He said, I'm not going to do it. And he ran to the U.S. bankruptcy judge, which is something I've never seen happen that quickly. He said, I don't trust that these actions are legal. Please give me guidance.
How close did they come to sending them the money? How was it a matter of days, weeks, or hours?
Hours. It got to the point where one of the New York attorneys for a U.S. firm sent the account numbers to the escrow agent and said, send it to this bank, to the Credit Bank of Moscow, which was sanctioned. And he said, you're not violating the sanctions. What is interesting about that, even in the email, he finished that email with a disclaimer, essentially saying, I'm not certifying that this is accurate and true legal advice, and it is not to be used for compliance purposes. Mm. That freaked the escrow agent out. The judge very quickly agreed, froze everything, and it's been going on for now close to a little over 2 years, everything remains frozen, and the U.S. attorneys has stepped in and said nothing's moving.
So, Emily, taking a step back, this is an example of a very, very unusual litigation finance situation where you have, you know, a foreign entity essentially financing a bankruptcy proceeding in the U.S. How unusual is this, though? Is this something that happens frequently, or do we even know?
So the reason that this has been up for debate prior to our story is because there is evidence of some sovereign wealth funds investing in litigation finance. Some people have viewed that as an issue, and whether it's okay for foreign entities to be involved in litigation finance or to what extent they're involved. So the bill in Congress is regarding disclosure of foreign entities, but it would ban foreign governments and sovereign wealth funds from investing in litigation finance. And that could have pretty big repercussions for the rest of the litigation finance industry, because they do, at least a handful that we know of, have money from sovereign wealth funds. But the concern is that it could be some sort of national security issue. If the foreign entities or foreign governments are funding a litigation, they could be privy to documents, you know, in U.S. corporations. That's what the concern is. A lot of the litigation funders say that's not an issue. Funders say that would never happen, or that investors don't get involved in the cases. And that's probably true for a lot of litigation funders, but we don't know.
In this case, we know they were directly involved. Dmitry Chernenko, who was the chief counsel for A1, was directing strategy and sending instruction to the U.S. attorneys. We have that through a series of emails. So at least in this case, there was direct involvement between the funder and the law firms.
Well, let's get back to A1. As you mentioned, you know, they were hours away from getting this payout that potentially could have violated U.S. sanctions on Russia. That didn't happen. The judge stepped in. The U.S. attorney stepped in. Everything is frozen. But now it sounds like the company is trying to find a way around the sanctions by selling A1 itself to someone who is not sanctioned for a very surprising amount of money. Explain what's going on there.
So, yeah, in the UK, the brother of this duo accused of embezzling $2 billion or defrauding $2 billion from the Russian bank, Georgi Bezhumov, has bankruptcy proceedings against him in the United Kingdom. And those are being funded by A1. When the owners of A1 were sanctioned, a few days later, they sold the company for $900 to another employee of A1 who is not sanctioned.
Not $900 million, not $900,000, $900.
Correct, $900. And to the lawyers representing Bezhumov, they thought that seemed like a pretty low amount. And it could be evidence of some sort of evasion of sanctions. And the owners who sold the company, or who sold A1, say that that's how much it's valued at. That's how much it's worth.
One quick thing about that, the stakes, the U.S. and the U.K. case, $20 million is what they've invested so far, this $900 company.
Wow. Finally, I want to hear from both of you guys, not about A1 and Russia and sanctions, but about litigation finance more broadly. It's very controversial, and I think your story has highlighted even more ways in which it can be concerning to a lot of people in the justice system. Where do you see this heading? It seems like there is, you know, some push to create new rules for this. There, as Emily mentioned, is a bipartisan bill on Capitol Hill to, you know, tighten rules on litigation finance. Do you see this practice being reined in sometime in the future, or do you think that there could be an overcorrection? What do you see happening? John, why don't you start?
My thought on this, more than anything that jumped out to me, is if you don't have regulations, nothing's going to stop it. There's too much money involved. The U.S. law firms of the U.K., it's a big part of their business if somebody's writing checks every week. There is absolutely no incentive and no way for a judge to know if it's involved. So if there's time for a settlement, who's calling the shots? It is impossible to rein in because there's too much money at stake, is my feeling based on what I've seen.
Emily, I'll give you the last word. What do you think?
I think that a lot of legitimately run litigation funders have absolutely no incentive to breach sanctions, and they're not. They're working by the book. But because it's not a regulated industry, there are other players that can come in pretty easily. And so I could see regulation coming in the next few years. It's already growing within the country. Different states are implementing it. If there is a federal bill, that would probably happen at some point. But I think overall, most of the funders are probably just doing their jobs, but we just don't know who was in the space because there's no disclosure and there's no regulation. So really anybody can come in.
All right. Well, that was Emily Siegel and John Holland talking with us about litigation finance and the strange saga of A1. Thank you guys so much for talking. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for today's episode of On the Merits. It was produced by myself, David Schultz. Our editor today was Andrew Satter. And our executive producer is Josh Block. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Finding relevant docket filings is crucial to winning your case. That's why Bloomberg Law is here to help you pinpoint winning arguments faster than before. Our best-in-class docket coverage just got better with enhanced AI-driven search and analytics, lightning-fast customized alerts, and expanded state court coverage. And we've substantially increased our litigation news coverage, so you'll never miss a beat. Don't miss the tools smart litigators rely on. Visit pro.bloomberglaw.com today and get everything you need to secure big wins.